Copyright in these lectures is either owned by the ANU or a third party who has licensed the ANU to use it. Students may use the recording for personal study only. No lecture may be communicated online, copied or shared without the prior permission of the ANU.
I'm just reminding myself what I said.
Go to listen to it.
Return to it while doing your thing.
No, oh,
okay.
Where is the...
Okay,
what
do you think of your...
It's feeling for me is okay. I love this country. I really love the country. It's amazing.
All right, colleagues, welcome to day two of the conference. I think we survived the very cold night almost intact. There are a few missing persons, but maybe they'll come once the sun is high enough. Before we start, as I indicated yesterday, this conference is about networking as well as academic discussion, and we are so privileged to have with us at the conference editors of two powerful, high-ranking journals. So I introduced Sebastian yesterday, the editor of Central Asian Affairs, and today I feel it's my responsibility to introduce Professor Vladiv Glover over there, the friendliest face on earth, as you can see, who is the editor of two journals, and you can actually find copies there for inspection only, not for the taking. And Transcultural Studies is my favorite, but of course a journal dedicated to Dostoevsky's literary legacy is also a fantastic publication. So Professor Vladiv Glover is very keen to explore possibilities of putting together a special issue dedicated to, well, the subject that we are discussing at this conference. So if you are interested, I think it would be a good idea to talk to Professor Vladiv Glover during coffee breaks or at lunchtime. And the indication is that, well, the journal will consider pieces between 5,000 and 6,000 words, and the timeline is actually quite accommodating. Final papers or papers for review must be delivered by March 2018. Well, that's what Professor Vladiv Glover will be happy to discuss with you. Yeah, exactly. But it's such a rare opportunity when it's not just some remote and morose editor who gargles with broken glass and eats babies for breakfast. It's just human beings you can do business with. So, but this session, of course, is one of the most pivotal happenings at the conference. Unfortunately, Milenko is not here. He might maybe on his way. Can I just arrogate to myself the privilege of time management here? And without further ado, the three excellent speakers who touch on really big and reasonably current and exceptionally topical issues. So Nick Fisher will speak first, and then we'll take it from them.
Thanks. Morning, everyone. Thank you for making it first up in the day. And I'm very pleased to be here to speak. I feel like a bit of a ring-in or an outlier as the kind of sole person who's not presenting on Soviet or Russian or greater Soviet issues. But Anyway, I'll get on with it because time's precious. As we all know, the last 100 years have delivered many shocks to global consciousness, but I think there's still an argument for saying that the Bolshevik Revolution was the most significant event, single event, of the 20th century. Government and business elites in the Western world were bewildered and horrified by the revolution. In the place of what had been an ally and a trading partner, there suddenly stood a socialist regime which withdrew from the World War, annulled the treaties of past governments and dishonoured their debts. And they endorsed violent class-based insurrection and land and resource nationalisation, and Western leaders resolved to crush international communism immediately. The fight against communism necessitated foreign and domestic political, economic and military crusades. And following the defeat of Germany, the Western allies invaded Russia, hoping to destroy the Red Army. But European nations and the US itself were racked with turmoil at this time. In 1919, 5 million workers struck in the United States, and race riots tore apart 25 cities. And terrorist bombings led to a nationwide dragnet of suspected communists. Now, in the popular imagination, fear of communist revolution died down after 1919 until it was revived with greater force in the late 1940s. Most of us know this era is generally known as the McCarthy era, after America's most notorious red baiter. And it's synonymous in the popular memory with Soviet subversion of America's government and culture, and with wars fought to counter Soviet aggression in Korea and Vietnam. And it's also remembered for the cultural repression exercised through such instruments as the Hollywood blacklist. But what you see is that the USSR was dominating not only global affairs, but also the internal affairs of its greatest rival in the Cold War. Now, I just want to focus on two principal problems, as I see them, with the historiography of anti-communism in the United States. And as you can see, it's manifest in two main areas, and that's the interplay between foreign and domestic affairs and the role of anti-communism in shaping both of these things at the same time. These are elucidated very well, not in relation to anti-communism, but to a slightly earlier period by Walter Karp. It makes the point that historians have generally dealt with foreign affairs and domestic affairs almost as if they're just separate things. And even if you talk about them in the same book, they'll be in separate chapters. But this is not the way that real life unfolds and that politics unfolds. So just to make some ground rules, anti-communism way predates Joseph McCarthy, and it predates the Red Scare of 1919. It actually it starts in the mid-19th century, and it was to a significant extent created and promoted by a network of activists, and it very much defined the boundaries of what was conceivable and inconceivable in 20th century politics. And while opposition to left-wing doctrines and organisations originating in Europe stimulated anti-communism and anti-radicalism, these sentiments were significant long before the rise of international communism, and which really emerged primarily in response to domestic tensions created by rapid industrialisation. Now, what domestic conditions encouraged the growth of a radical left? First, the condition of labour. So after the Civil War, the principle of forcing people to labour in intolerable conditions for intolerable terms became a basic feature of working life. Second, after the Civil War, corporations became the great political power in the United States. And third, demographic change. American agribusiness in particular drove independent farmers in the US and in Europe off the land. This led to mass migration to American industrial centres, placing unprecedented stress on the labour market, infrastructure and social cohesion. It's worth remembering that the US was a shockingly unequal society at this time, whereas prior to the Civil War, more than half of the nation's wealth had been held by the richest 29%. A generation later, just 1% held the same amount of wealth. Workers bore the brunt of regular and prolonged recession. Escalating protest was blamed on the flood of aliens arriving in America, bringing with them polluting notions of class warfare. The plight of the working classes also fuelled fears of the revolutionary threat that they posed to an ill-equipped state. And a succession of workers and people's movements were attacked as communist conspiracies. In the Depression of the 1870s, unemployed workers' councils were described as communists, internationalists, demagogues, and evil-disposed persons. Major strikes, unions, and causes were all crushed and also described as the work of terrorist organisations preaching nothing more nor less than French communists. So I'll just... this, by the way, is if anyone knows about the Pullman strike of 1894... Well, we might go into it later. Better keep moving. Now, I want to jump forward a bit to 1917. By this time, American capitalists had been expanding their power in foreign locales as well for several decades. And as at home, this power brought them into conflict with the peoples of Hawaii, Latin America, and the Philippines. So American vexation with Bolshevism needs to be understood in the context of hitherto rapid and unimpeded expansion of American commerce and industry. So this expansion was the business community's solution to the economic ills that the US was experiencing, and it urged the government to build a modern navy to help advance that commerce. The navy was completed in 1896. It got straight down to work. Marines had actually helped depose the Queen of Hawaii in 1893. In 1898, the US annexed Hawaii and then declared war on Spain and added Cuba and the Philippines to its territory. For the next 30 years, the defensive investments in Latin America required constant military action to prop up corrupt and dictatorial governments and suppress revolutionary movements. It's worth just taking a second to absorb the map. I certainly needed to. But Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Venezuela, the island of the Dominican Republic, and Haiti, as well as Cuba, are all important in this story. As you can see, there's a story of constant, repeated intervention and long-term occupation. And Panama and Nicaragua. I certainly didn't realise in the 1980s when I was a boy that Ronald Reagan's war against the Sandinistas just represented the continuation of, 75 years of interference in that country's affairs. So 1914, Woodrow Wilson, who later authorised the invasion of Bolshevik Russia, ordered US troops to occupy Veracruz to help safeguard American investments, as he was bungling political and military intervention in the Mexican Revolution. Like the more famously jingoistic Theodore Roosevelt, Wilson believed in enlarging US global power through trade, but he also learned in Mexico that politics and trade can be a dangerous mix. So in 1918, he was stressing that the US was promoting democracy only for those peoples that wanted it. And these claims made him a popular figure in Europe, and it aroused great hope, especially among colonial subjects who were looking for liberation and national self-determination. Yet his administration was almost also committed to channeling these aspirations of arbitrarily defined nations into arrangements compatible with Western interests. And by opposing self-determination in Russia, Turkey, Hungary, Germany, Egypt, Ireland, and the Philippines, and India, the Allies showed that the foreign policy was really a project of imperial governance in which nation-states carved from defunct empires would operate as Western military and economic clients against Bolshevism. The US interfered in the Russian Civil War, and that intensified, enlarged and extended that war, and with it the material and human costs of the revolution. And the US, British, French and Japanese retention of their colonies was decried across Asia, including by Ho Chi Minh and Mao, who dismissed the policy of national self-regulation as shameless rhetoric. So I want to turn now to the sources and purposes of anti-communism in the United States. There's no denying that many Americans feared the USSR and believed that it was working tirelessly to subvert America. But anti-communism was used deliberately by various persons and entities to facilitate personal, professional and corporate enrichment. And we can discern the politico-economic functions of anti-communism in legislation and in some notable political careers. The first modern law to advance political repression was the Espionage Act, which allowed the federal government to prescribe conduct or speech injurious to a war effort or aided an enemy. It imposed huge fines and draconian prison sentences, and it's still in use today. Bradley/Chelsea Manning was charged with 6 counts of violating this act and sentenced in 2013 to 35 years jail. I just want to talk about the Criminal Syndicalism Act. Between March 1917 and 1919, 23 states enacted criminal syndicalism statutes which outlawed any organisation committed to violently overthrowing the government or changing the ownership of industry. But these acts were really just used to censor any form of protest against industry and employers. They were used to just utterly destroy the industrial workers of the world in the 1920s and then were revived in the 1930s to similarly suppress the Communist Party. So I'll come back to the Wagner Act, which was what finally gave American workers the right to be represented in organisations. Anti-strike injunctions had been legalised in 1877. So workers were, when they struck, were routinely subjected to beatings, false imprisonment, eviction from their homes, deportation, corporate-backed lynching. And between 1880 and 1930, there were almost 2,000 anti-strike injunctions, and about half of those were issued in the 1920s. But the Wagner Act was weakened at the outset by its exclusion of domestic and agricultural workers. The National Labor Relations Board was disrupted by employers challenging its jurisdiction, and then soon after, a congressional committee alleged that it had been subverted by communists, and legislation further really neutered its independence and capacity. And then it was made fully redundant by the Taft-Hartley Act, which prescribed secondary boycotts and restricted any strike to a 60-day negotiation period, and enabled employers to threaten employees with reprisals for organising. It has been called a New Deal for employers. Then there's a raft of legislation restricting political rights are enacted between 1939 and 54. The Act to Prevent Pernicious Political Activities targeted communists working in government. The Alien Registration Act made a federal crime of advocating revolution and introduced a compulsory alien registration scheme. The McCarran Act required communist organisations to register with the US Attorney General, and the Control Act outlawed the party. Now, 11 states passed statutes similar to the McCarran Act. 8 states outlawed the Communist Party. So by 1950, 32 states had banned subversives from government agencies. By 1970, 45 states had passed anti-sedition laws. 32 states subjected its employees, including university professors, to loyalty oaths. Now, anti-communism led to the development of a new surveillance state, and it essentially made the nation's premier police division the FBI. During the Red Scare, an anti-radical division was formed, and it was placed in the care of John Edgar Hoover, who for the next 45 years ruled the Bureau in a Stalin-like fashion. Throughout his term, he used the threat of communism to justify the continuous surveillance of American citizens and organisations. And the ultimate objective of this state was to maximise social control. It changed the focus of the FBI from one of law enforcement to outright harassment and confrontation of suspects for allegedly deviant conduct or speech. The labour movement remained a target for infiltration and harassment, along with African-American and anti-war activists. And in recent times, the threat of terrorism has supplanted communism as the principal justification for extraordinary security powers. Since September 2001, the FBI has interpreted individual statements of opposition to US foreign policy as a sign of possible terrorist inclinations, and it's targeted the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, the Green Party, the anti-war movement, and the Catholic Church. This, by the way, is David Levine's magnificent caricature of Hoover at the time of his death. Now, anti-communism is often dubbed McCarthyism, but it could just as well be dubbed Reaganism. Ronald Reagan was a handsome, aspiring actor from Illinois who made his way to Hollywood in the late 1930s and worked under contract for Warner Brothers. One of his most popular roles you can see here was as George the Gipper Gip, and he was a college footballer who died in 1920 of a throat infection. This is from the 1940 film Knut Rockne, All-American. And he was still called the Gipper when he was president. But after war service, his career had petered out in financial and artistic nadir. By the early 1950s, he was starring in films like Bedtime for Bonzo here, where he played a psychology professor as second fiddle to a chimpanzee. And he never liked talking about this film. So he had political ambitions and he became the president of the Screen Actors Guild, but at the same time he'd been recruited by the FBI as an informant. And so he was secretly helping to destroy the careers of several noted actors that he was pretending to represent. But in 1954, General Electric made him the host of its weekly television program, which was really the making of his political career. When he toured GE facilities and spoke at social clubs and whatever, he promoted the conservative, anti-union, small government views of his employers, but he also burnished his public image and his communication skills at the same time. And as president, he very loyally advanced the interests of the corporations and employer lobbies that had helped him. He suppressed labour organisation. He unilaterally dismissed 10,000 air traffic strikers in 1981, and he re-legitimised strike breaking with scab labour. Now, since the USSR collapsed, foreign and domestic policy in the US has been triumphal. You know, the US won the Cold War because the offer that it made its citizens and its allies was superior. But the issue of why, and the equally important issue of when the offer was better, is often ignored. And I think it's odd to observe that the US was actually at its strongest when the USSR was also at its strongest. It's in the 1950s and 60s that all relevant indicators of social health improved as never before in US history, that the benefits of prosperity spread to more citizens than ever before. But there were still problems. More money always went to the military than to any other combined causes to contain communism. The US was hit by recession and foreign competition in the late 1960s. This began to destroy the manufacturing sector. Blue-collar workers had no protection in Taft-Hartley world. And crime was soaring, and this was blamed on African-Americans who became the principal victims of a new program of mass imprisonment. Business lobbies were dominating economic policy, and they pushed a pure laissez-faire agenda in which any schemes such as national health insurance, anti-discrimination laws, housing programs, federal education program were all derided as socialist. And a champion of these policies, Barry Goldwater, won the presidential nomination for the GOP in 64. But where Goldwater and even Nixon failed, Reagan succeeded. He endorsed big business's restoration of pre-Depression disparities of wealth and income. And since his inauguration, income inequality has exploded in the US. So I'll just quickly try and account for why this happened. As memories of the Great Depression faded, you had stagflation in the 1970s, and this demonstrated the limits of post-war Keynesian consensus. And at the same time, China and the Soviet Union were liberalising their economic systems. In this environment, the anti-state prescriptions, particularly of the Chicago School of Economics, were accepted as gospel. And the failure of communism, which was hastened by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, culminated in serious suggestions, most famously by Francis Fukuyama, that the world had come to the end of history in the form of Western liberal capitalist democracy. And proponents of laissez-faire were left unchallenged and felt no need to protect the left flank anymore by conceding even a marginal redistribution of wealth. So, the US in the age of Trump. I mean, anti-communism, I think, in many respects, is best viewed as the ultimate diversion from systemic flaws in domestic policies and conditions. It made impossible a welfare state. But, you know, in many respects, it also led to the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of soldiers' lives in wars of choice, the overthrow of democratically elected governments in Latin America and Iran, and then it just faded away to be replaced by first the war on drugs and then the war on terror. But it's been a tragedy for the United States in a way that the USSR fell, because it's been left to be its own worst self. And it's now hollowed out, it's in debt, doesn't give its citizens a good shot. It's an intern nation. And the presidential election is now a drama, as Matt Taibbi, the journalist, says, that Americans have learned to consume wholly as entertainment, divorced completely from any concrete expectations of changes in their own lives. And I think this trend reaches its apotheosis with the election of Trump, who's the ultimate fraud, posing as the people's warrior. Without the USSR to impose a modicum of discipline on the pro-business elements and ideology that's always dominated the US, it's once again a morass of inequality and division. Its future as a superpower, I believe, is more uncertain than it has been for generations. Anyway, if anybody is interested, you can read much more about this in my book. And I'll modestly say I have a few copies for sale if anyone would like one. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Carol. And I was struck by Nick's paper, given that I'll almost be addressing a similar theme in a way. One of the messages out of it, I suppose, was that the US will miss the USSR. And my paper, which is on contemporary Russian foreign and security policy, seems to demonstrate to me, at least, in terms of the tensions between the United States, if not Trump himself, but tensions between the United States and the Western allies on the one hand and Russia on the other, that perhaps there is a sense of nostalgia for the stability of the relative stability of the Cold War era. Now, I'm very much indebted to Kirill for suggesting or reminding me that this conference was coming back on, because I thought, oh yes, I'll write something about Russian foreign and security policy. But then it decided, well, I'll do more than that. I'll write it right now, and I'll send it off to a journal. Actually, this paper is going to appear in about 3 weeks' time in the Australian Journal of International Affairs. So I approach this paper with a little bit of trepidation, given that nothing you say to me I can do anything about. It's probably full of egregious errors. of concept and possibly of fact as well. So I apologise for all these things in advance. The paper and the subsequent article, I gave a deliberately provocative title, and that was The Triumph of Russian National Security Policy. I do put a question mark after that. Focus particularly on Russia's rapid rebound. What do I mean by rebound? Well, one of the things that I like to do to pass the time, given that I have no life as an academic, especially one at ANU, is to think about how we understand and how we conceptualize power in international relations and in international security. And it strikes me, when looking at the literature on this topic, that we know an awful lot about what happens when states lose power. There's an enormous amount of writing on how states lose power through war. They lose it through overstretch. Prompted, of course, by all sorts of contemporary scholarship about the relative decline of the United States, we now... Hi, Rod, how are you? We now know an awful lot about prospective policy strategies that might be employed to manage those kinds of declines in power, whether it's a retreat to offshore balancing or whether it's various retrenchment strategies. As usual, the international relations literature is very keen to jump on current trends, and it has done so in terms of power transitions in terms of a slow or gradual decline. So we know about that. We also know a lot about how states gain power over time and over a lengthy period of time. This is prompted, of course, today by the rise of China and seeking to explain how China has managed to emerge as the effective powerhouse of the global economy. And there are various precipitating and intermediate, but also deep and structural causes one might identify for the emergence of Chinese power. One thing we don't know a lot about, though, is what happens when a country loses a lot of power and then seeks to get it back quickly. Okay? And you might say, well, there's a good reason for that, and that is because it doesn't happen very often, and if it does, it's only temporary and it fails. There's a little bit of writing on the so-called Phoenix factor. This came out in the sort of late 1970s, early 1980s, about states that sort of are reborn from the ashes and manage to uplift themselves to new positions of prominence, particularly after war. There's some writing, for instance, about France and its ability to reconsolidate itself in the aftermath of World War II. But we have to acknowledge, I think, that France after World War II not only was on the winning side, but faced a highly advantageous set of circumstances. It was not only the recipient of large amounts of US reconstruction and aid, but it was also secured by a blanket US guarantee within Western Europe that was then solidified in 1949 with the formation of the NATO alliance. So the structural conditions and the domestic conditions, in fact, given that France was relatively untouched by World War II, or at least its major centres were relatively strong. When we look at rebounds, though, I think that Russia fits the bill quite nicely, at least on the surface. Russia has been written off on many occasions. It was initially, in the aftermath of the Cold War, viewed as a country that was seeking to ingratiate itself to the West, seeking to find its place in the common European home, seeking to integrate itself within Western security structures and economic structures. It was only a very few short years after that, in 1994, that President Bill Clinton started referring to Russia as a problem to be managed, but effectively one, which he did in his State of the Union address, but effectively one that could be managed and that one that was not particularly important in terms of upsetting global order in any way. And that was for good reasons, or so it seemed at the time. The world was full of post-Cold War peace dividends. We subscribed, or many subscribed, to the Fukuyama end of history thesis. We were all going to be peace-loving Democrats because, of course, the great big tension in historical argument over ideology had been sorted and democracy capitalism and sort of democratic individualism was the victor. Now, certainly if you look at Russian history, Russian economics, from 1991 through to about 1999, you would think that this was a fair assessment. But under Putin, like him or not, he has managed to do a variety of things that today, if we look at Russian power, would seem at least to have achieved quite a bit over a short amount of time. Although, and Graham Gill will tell me, will certainly give me some more feeders, more pointers on this, although the Russian economy and the Russian economic model is highly undiversified, although it relies primarily on natural resources, nonetheless, under Putin, GDP per capita in Russia has increased about 15 times in the space of 17 years. That's not a bad accomplishment, frankly, from someone who came to power saying that, well, it'll take about 8-9 years before we get the GDP of Portugal. Such was the poor state of the Russian economy when Putin inherited it. We know, of course, about Russia becoming a much more assertive actor on the international stage, particularly through oil and gas leverage, its construction of energy dependencies with respect to Western European countries, especially Germany, but others as well. One reason why attempts to constrain Russia are highly problematic, because you have so many EU states that are reliant on Gazprom, at least for the moment. This translates into quite profound political leverage over those countries. We also have the events of not so much the war, the five-day war with Georgia, but particularly the seizure of Crimea, in which, of course, the friendly green men without insignia took over very, very quickly and very, very simply, backed up by a raft of information, operations and cyber. And, of course, given Russia's noted or apparent role in the recent US presidential elections, even if Russia has not been responsible in any way for the DNC hack, nonetheless, everybody thinks it was. So, therefore, this is a big power maximizer. There is a general sense of worry, I think, among Western democratic societies that Russian cyber and Russian information operations are in some way omnipotent, that every time there's a hack, every time that there's... well, I mean, the most recent one was posing as ransomware, but was certainly state-sponsored, and the first target was Ukraine. But that Russia is the leading or framework actor when it comes to the assertive use of cyber affairs or cyber policy. Is this the case, though? Has Russia rebounded rapidly, and how would I frame it? So then I got to thinking, you know, what types of factors might constitute or by which we might assess or measure a rebound in terms of a national security strategy. And I've identified a few of them. I won't spend too long talking about them. More than happy to address them in Q&A. But effectively, they are as follows. One, a state seeking to rebound has a relatively short time frame in which to accomplish its task. In Russia, of course, we know that there is probably a 10 to 15 year window of opportunity for the Russian Federation to establish itself as a realistic player in Asia, whereas previously, of course, it's been more or less invisible since the collapse of communism, despite some attempts. The other factor I'd identify as being important for a rebound is a strategic re-emphasis on territory and on hard power. The third is the construction of alternative networks of influence and control. And the fourth is active attempts to undermine the normative and legal orthodoxies of the time. Now, I think Russia has done all of these things, and I look at them in terms of a variety of categories, three main categories. One, its military security posture. Second, its trade and economic profile. To some extent institutionally, but also looking at its bilateral efforts. And finally, its normative strategy, which includes information warfare. Let me talk about each of those in a little bit of detail. Let's start with its military security posture. Well, prior to Putin inheriting the reins of the Russian Federation, we know that its military capability was constrained incredibly markedly. Not only had there been two very costly wars in Chechnya, but also the capacity of the federal government to pay for its military had contracted sharply, especially following the 1997 financial crisis. It was quite commonplace that prisoners in Russian jails would eat better than its soldiers. Its soldiers were frequently not paid. Sometimes when they were paid, they were offered payment in grain and in building materials. We know that the Pacific Fleet in Vladivostok was rotting at anchor, that Russia had virtually no power projection capability whatsoever within the Pacific theatre. We know also that it was forced, due to this conventional weakness, to adopt an assured first use strategy in terms of weapons of mass destruction. So having gone from, during the Cold War, maintaining a no first use posture, where in fact NATO said they might use nuclear weapons first, it then went to a potential first use of nuclear weapons to then an assured first use of nuclear weapons. That's actually got even more nasty because the Russians are abandoning deterrence. The Russians have stationed permanently short-range ballistic missiles in Kaliningrad, and their new military doctrine says, well, we will start conventional wars and then we'll threaten the use of weapons of mass destruction in order to back up our gains. But nonetheless, due to this weakness, the Russians were forced to rely on deterrence primarily to secure their territory. It also prompted Putin, once he had renationalized oil and gas and had ready cash at his disposal, it also prompted Putin's quite ambitious $600 billion rearmament plan. And some of that is beginning to bear fruit now. It's found in the form of new SSBNs, which have been deployed partly in the Northern Fleet and partly in the Pacific Fleet, new combat-ready divisions, investment in high-tech things like the new Armata tank, and so forth. And we know also that Russia has been trying very, very hard to secure its periphery and secure the post-Soviet space with varying degrees of success. Its initial attempt to do so in a trade and economic framework was the CIS. In a military security framework, of course, it's been the CSTO. But due to repeated wrangles over membership, who's in, who's out, who participates, how much, Russia has really only been able to construct what I call a constrained form of primacy over Central Asia. And that form of primacy is being chipped away at and chipped away at and chipped away at. The main reason for that, I think, is because China has been especially good at sheeting security burdens home to the Russians while paying for none of it. Effectively, the Chinese posture in its own near abroad, Central Asia, has been to say to Russia, sure, you look after the security situation there. You take the lead when it comes to the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan causing problems. You take the lead when it comes to potential color revolutions. What we will do is sign up those states to a variety of different bilateral deals, primarily relating to energy, but also as Belt and Road takes shape, increasingly focusing on infrastructure projects, which gives China quite profound strategic leverage in the Central Asian space. So I would argue, therefore, that Russia's military security posture, although it looks much more robust now than it did in the late 1990s, is nonetheless quite tenuous and being progressively chipped away at. And I think the story's the same when we look at Putin's trade agenda, his economic agenda. The big flagship, of course, of Putin's regional or global approach to trade was his Eurasian, or it continues to be his Eurasian Union. And really, this hasn't yielded much fruit whatsoever. Has not been a successful counterweight to the European Union. It is not a successful counterweight to Chinese bilateralism, and it is primarily Chinese bilateralism in the form of its Belt and Road initiatives. And it has struggled to attract many states to sign up as members. Coupled to the Eurasian Union has been a much more concerted, since 2013, push into Asia. Now, Russia has said this on numerous occasions, that it would need to pivot to the Asia-Pacific, but it's only been in recent years that it's really tried very hard. If you go to Southeast Asia now, you'll continue to find
Russian trade ministry officials running around all over the place wanting to sign up deals on roads, on rails, on rail, on critical infrastructure, selling tanks, selling planes, and so forth. But this has been primarily opportunistic rather than strategic. It's been primarily bilateral in orientation and lacks a sort of firm multilateral underpinning that might signify that Russia is coming to Asia to stay. I think Russia is coming to Asia to try and see what it can get, but not necessarily establish itself as a major player in that space. It's worth noting, of course, that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Russia initially saw as a military security counterweight to NATO, has evolved along with Chinese preferences, that it became an energy trading club, that it's now part of Belt and Road. Oh, wow, quick. No worries, I've been crapping on for ages. Sorry, folks. That it's part of Belt and Road, that the expanded SCO basically serves Chinese preferences more than it does Russia's. Now, I also look at normative strategy. And, of course, here we have the social manoeuvring that's conducted by the Russian government following the so-called Gerasimov Doctrine, which sees information as part of total war, that sees any attempt to manipulate or transform the perceptions of people within Western societies as a good thing, based on the assumption that Western publics are brittle, that they're weak. And I think there is some evidence to validate that. Does this mean, though, that Russia has rebounded very rapidly and that this is going to be enduring? In the short amount of time left to me, I will give you my argument, which is essentially no, and that is that Russia's overall trajectory is downwards, and I think that Putin realises this. I think that he recognises that within 10 years, the United States will be shipping energy to Asia in a big way, which will produce large amounts of competition, that his pivot to Asia is primarily an energy pivot. I think also that there's no real plausible alternative to a very hard American reset on Russia. Let's say Trump lasts one term, we'll be generous. What happens after? If it's the GOP, they will not want to look internally and they will want to blame the Russian Federation. If it's the Democrats, they'll be out for revenge. Effectively, the rebound then has done little more, I think, than buy Putin time. But how much time is still in question? My guess would be about 5 years, and that's not long enough to reconsolidate Russia as the Euro-Pacific great power that Putin envisages. Thank you very much, folks.
Ian, we'll finish this fantastic panel if we manage the digital version of it, yeah, which I think is happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, look, thanks very much, Kirill, and thanks very much also to the two previous speakers, but particularly to Matthew, because I think a lot of what I would like to say has actually will complement what Matthew has said. I mean, essentially what I'll seek to cover in a very short time, and taking advantage of what Matthew has said, Russia's relations with the Middle East to 2011, but then afterwards, when after the Arab Spring got going, domestic factors that I think have influenced Putin in his strategy in the Middle East, and the consequences of Russian policy in the Middle East for key states in that region, and how they've reacted to it. Where I think Putin's Middle East policy is now headed, and lastly, the impact of the Putin-Trump relationship on how the US and Russia deal with the region, which is still playing out. It seems to me, having read quite a bit of what Putin has done in the Middle East, that his aims come down to the following. I don't think he necessarily wants to take over the US role in the Middle East. He sees the US as vulnerable there, but I think he sees the Middle East as part of a broad Russian strategy. and that the Middle East is a second-order priority for him. His reason for taking an interest in the Middle East is that there is scope there to oppose the US regional role there, but also to, as I'll explain later, to get bargaining chips that could be useful in other parts of the world, possibly with Ukraine, and also out of domestic security. He wants to ensure that Muslim-majority provinces in Russia don't actually become a menace for internal security. And finally, having seen what the US has done in the Middle East over the past 15 years, he wants to avoid US mistakes, which is very wise, it seems to me. The analytical challenge in actually trying to see what Putin is up to is that I think he tends not to have a strategy at the moment as far as the Middle East is concerned. I think he's got more of a methodology that he's sniffing out and looking for opportunities and then seeking to exploit them. Putin himself, as any of you who saw the Oliver Stone interviews and other interviews that Putin has given, adopts a deliberately opaque public persona. So it's very hard to get a clear idea from what he says of what he plans to do. There are a lot of influences that one can claim Putin is being exercised on Putin. I won't go into the KGB issue. I think he's been president of Russia long enough for that not to be so much of a factor. But trying to see where Putin is coming from, it's actually quite useful to see his spoken words. And at the 2015 Valdai conference, I'll explain that if any of you are unaware of it, but he made the comment that 50 years ago he learned on the streets of St. Petersburg, he said Leningrad, of course, that if the fight is inevitable, be the first to strike. I think that and other comments that Putin has made indicate that he has an approach to the world where he sees a lot of enemies, a lot of people who would like to take advantage of Russia, and he is determined to make sure that doesn't happen. Gary Kasparov, the former chess grandmaster, has famously described Putin as a poker player, as a master of bluff. And the surprise factor was something that actually affected Australia in 2014. You'll recall that our Prime Minister at the time, Tony Abbott, made the somewhat ill-advised comment that he was going to shirt front Putin. Now, apart from uncertainty as to how that might translate into Russian, and I think many of us were uncertain how it translated into English, we were actually very keen to see how Putin might react to this. Now, what he did was that he sent down to the Brisbane area while the G20 summit was taking place, the US naval ship, the Varyag, which is one of its largest, a guided missile vessel, very, very large ship. And now, as a protocol, the Australian Navy sent out one of their ships in the region to greet the Varyag. Problem was that the ship that they sent was only one-tenth the size of the Varyag. So Putin had quite clearly made his points. Just finally, I think it's worth, in terms of discerning influences on Putin, looking at comments by those who have made them. And I've found the comments by Nikolai Patrushev, the secretary of the Russian NSC, to be comments that are worth taking note of. I'll get back to him later. I'm not sure, is it Patrushev or Patrushev?
Patrushev.
Stress on first syllable.
Okay, all right, thank you. I'll try to get it right now. Anyway, and the analytical challenge is further enhanced by the fact that we're still waiting to see exactly how the Putin-Trump relationship is going to play out. It seemed to me that after the U.S. attack on the Syrian town of Khan Sheikhoun, after the U.S. strike on the area where the Syrian attack on the town of Khan Sheikhoun, where there had been a CW attack, was somewhat pro forma. Putin himself didn't make a direct comment. He left it to his press secretary. And it raises the question, is the door still open? And we have the now confirmed news that there will be a meeting between Putin and Trump next month. And the other aspect that's still to play out are U.S. domestic factors. Trump doesn't know quite how they're going to play out, nor does Putin at this stage. Now, I'll just go through this very, very quickly because this is really historical. But Putin would be aware of the history of where Russia's Middle East policy comes from. It was a major theater during the Cold War, and the Soviet interests were to prevent U.S. containment from its southeast flank. It was strategic because of the strategic region that the Middle East mentioned, referenced, and also the fact that oil at that stage was very largely a commodity which the Middle East dominated. The other aspect was, you could call ideological. There was an opportunity with a number of countries emerging from a colonial past to actually proselytize with the aim of expanding Soviet influence in the region. It centered during the Cold War and the struggle for Egypt. Nasser played off the U.S. and the Russians for some time, but then was happy to opt for the Soviets. That seemed to be working okay until the 67 war, which was not only a major defeat for Egypt and other Arab countries, it was also a major defeat for Soviet arms. Shortly afterwards, by 1972, Sadat had opted for the U.S., and he then got back at the Israelis with the 1973 war, which, I'd have to say, in the end was a draw, but it really did frighten the Israelis at the time because they were taken by surprise. And having done so well in the early stages of the war, Sadat was then able to start seeking an honourable peace. The U.S. took up the baton on this very skillfully, ended up with the Camp David Accords, and the Soviets in the Middle East were really left with Syria at that point. They signed a treaty of friendship and cooperation with the Syrians. They had access to the port of Tartus, but essentially they were out of the game. The U.S., for all practical purposes, had won the Cold War battle for the Middle East. Russia's situation was made even more difficult in the 80s with getting bogged down in Afghanistan and then subsequently internal turmoil which finally led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. In this time, Syria was a sleeping asset, and the US went ahead with what seemed like a remarkable array of positive outcomes. The Oslo Accord, peace treaties, and then going into Afghanistan and Iraq from 2003, before these two went very bad. Russian domestic factors that would be influencing Putin. Russia was obviously geostrategically weak after 1991, and it was I lived in Russia in the 90s, and it was a sense of, it was a sense of shame among Russians when NATO expanded to include Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary. That has underlined the weakened status of Russia. Then when it expanded further to include the Baltic state, it was now right up at Russia's border. Despite the 1999 expansion of NATO, Putin initially did seek a degree of accommodation with the West. You'll recall in his early years he had a very good relationship with Schroeder, the German Chancellor, and with Chirac. But as well as that, he was the first foreign leader to phone Bush after the 9/11 attack. It seems to me, just from looking closely at what Putin has been doing, is that this changed in 2004 with the expansion, further expansion of NATO. Now, in 2005, he described the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Now, he was obviously, or he claims he was referring to the fact that it left 25 million Russian citizens outside Russia at that point. But it was taken by many in the West, including me at that stage, as an indication that he had a certain wistful reminiscence of what the Soviet Union was about. And I wonder if that may have been deliberate ambiguity. The gloves really came off at the 2007 NATO Security Conference in Munich. He accused the US of seeking to establish sole dominance of the globe, and the restoration of Russia's lost international standing, it seemed to me from then, was clearly a primary foreign policy goal of Putin. Now, for this, he seemed to have strong domestic support. First of all, he was a much better manager than his predecessor Yeltsin had been. He brought a strong administrative discipline. He helped very much then by the global resource price rises in the 20th century, which enabled him to shore up his power base with his system of rewarding the oligarchs around him, but the public also benefited. He also turned to greater foreign policy assertiveness at that stage, which it was very popular with Russians. In visits I made to Russia at that time, it was evident that there was there was general grassroots approval of Putin. I don't know if I go along with the huge approval ratings shown in the various polls, but it was significant. I won't go into these key developments. They've really been handled very capably by Matthew. But the turning point as far as the Middle East was concerned came with the Arab Spring. Putin, up to 2011, had shown very little interest in the Middle East and was really quite happy to leave it to the US. But the Arab Spring was actually undermining a lot of US strategy in the Middle East. And not only that, this is probably more serious for Putin, it was a perceived boost to the Orange Revolutions. He was concerned that something like the Arab Spring could actually have a further influence that could come directly to him. But importantly, he now had scope to use the Middle East against the US. And he had, I would say, realist objectives in doing this. He wanted to counter US policies and to create in the Middle East and to create bargaining chips in that way. I'll get onto that quickly later. He wanted to expand Russian economic interests. There were very, very significant arms sales that were developing. And he also, as with the Soviet Union, wanted to contain the risk of jihadism. Now, many in the West were surprised when Putin authorized the Syrian intervention. Looking back on it, it probably should not have been a surprise. I won't go into the details of what happened in Libya, but there was no doubt that the Russians certainly believed that in allowing a resolution to pass in the UN Security Council, allowing the protection of civilians, responsibility to protect, that they were dudded by the West. That the West used it in order to get rid of Gaddafi, which was not what the Russians had in mind at all. He was determined there would be no repeat of all that in Syria. But in 2015, that explains some of his UN votes. In 2015, there's no doubt that Assad was in serious danger. There were forecasts that that the Alawite regime could fall. Putin was determined that this wouldn't happen. He saw this as being something that the West would see as a victory, particularly since they'd called for Assad to go. But as well as that, getting involved in Syria was in line with his nationalist foreign policy. And at that time, and I was in Russia in 2015, it had a bonus of reducing public focus on the fact that the Russian economy was going backwards at that stage. I won't go into the details of this, but it was a very well-judged and carefully calibrated intervention, very cleverly done on Putin's part. But probably best of all from his perspective, as well as saving Assad, was that there was a huge refugee outflow to Europe, which started to put pressure on the EU, which had some factors later. He had enormous success in the Middle East among Middle Eastern states. All of them were very impressed with the fact that Putin was determined to stand by Assad, whereas Obama was seen as having abandoned Mubarak. I won't go into the details of those, but the relationship was much better with all of these states as a result of going into Syria. Now, working out just what Trump's impact on this might be is still a bit of a problem, because his Middle East policies are really not defined. They're more a set of instincts. He clearly sees it as being a source of international terrorism. Trump himself has a very strong and instinctive support for Israel, and he has even more instinctive hostility towards Iran. Now, the more sensible people in the Trump administration may have had some success in moderating some of his behaviour, but we still remain to see what will happen. But there's no doubt that in the Middle East, Trump is far more popular than Obama. The problem for that is that the Middle East is now more complicated for Putin. There's less anti-US feeling to exploit. The reaction against Russia in the region has meant it's harder for Russia, harder for Trump to make good on his promise or his pledge that he would work with Russia to solve Syria. The St. Petersburg bomb wasn't caused by anyone in the Middle East, as far as we're aware, but it did raise the risk of an Islamist backlash. And the question of an exit strategy is something that Putin will have to think about very hard now. The objectives have been largely achieved. Putin's challenge now is to make a decision on when Assad and those others assisting him, Iran and Hezbollah, can actually manage without Russian air support. He could abandon Assad, not necessarily the Alawite regime, but he could get arrange to get someone that he can manage better than Assad in charge of the regime. He doesn't show signs of wanting to do this. But he's primarily got a very realist approach to the Middle East. He's not seeking to supplant US primacy. He realises that there's no scope in the Middle East for Russian soft power, whereas under the Soviets they were able to exploit some soft power. I can go into that in more detail later if you like. And also he realised that even though regional states had been very anti-Obama over the years, they're not necessarily going to align with Russia as a result. So in summary, I'd say that in what Putin is doing in the Middle East, he's not seeking the global foreign policy of the Cold War that the Soviets were seeking. Firstly, it's because he has a realistic appreciation of what Russia's capabilities are. As Matthew explained, there's still quite a lot of building up to be done. And so I see what is happening in Syria and in the rest of the Middle East as being tactical at this stage rather than strategic. It's part of a wider goal to pressure the US and the West to create potential bargaining chips, obviously over Ukraine sanctions, and also to get other benefits in Europe as well. Brexit is one that he would be very happy with. Marine Le Pen, I wouldn't rule out at this point. When Macron, the shine goes off him, she may well come back. I've already talked about the aims that Putin has there. So I hope I have convinced you the Middle East is the second order priority for Putin. And his main strategic focus, I would suggest, is the US, the West broadly, and China. But it's not just my suggestion. A very good analyst, Bobo Lowe, with whom I worked in Syria many years ago, sees that as being Putin's aim at this point. But this is clearly beyond Russia for now. The West is too hostile towards him, and Russia's economy is too weak. In the meantime, I suggest that Putin will bide his time and look for opportunities, and will inevitably surprise us.
Right. Many apologies. It's such an exciting panel, but time is of the essence because we have back-to-back sessions. So when you formulate a question, please keep it to the minimum and clearly identify the target of your criticism. All right. We'll start with Amin and then go like this.
Take the
mic
of
the
three speakers
that have
come out, I suppose, next theme was the Russian States made use of the Soviet threat to do nasty things to its own people and also the world. And my first theme was that Russia has rebounded, but souffle. And I guess the theme of Haynes that the talk was that Russia is basically an opportunist power in the Middle East and basically has adopted a critical approach to what's been going on. But let me just dwell on the point that you're making. Yes, at what level, yes, Russia is adopted an approach which is focusing more on exploiting opportunities which come its way. And of course, in Syria, that is really true. Largely because of that Obama backed down in 2013 when the Assad regime crossed the line. And I think that really opened the door wide open. And of course, also the fact that the United States of the invasion of Iraq was a total matter. I mean, that also opened the way for not only for Iran, but also to some extent through Iran, that Russia could have some influence in Iraq. But what has really happened, and I think that's very important, that Moscow, Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Hezbollah axis has developed. And what that's really done, that's sort of divided the Gulf into two hostile parts. You've got the northern part of the Gulf, which is dominated by a sort of a Russia-Iran-led de facto alliance. And then the southern part is very much a US-led alliance under the influence of US alliance. This is a new fault line which has come on the top of all other fault lines in the region. And this is not going to really go away. This is something that I think the regional actors and the international actors will have to really battle in terms of if you want to really bring stability and security to the Middle East. So in other words, Putin's approach will be tactical. But at the same time, it does have important strategic effects. and of course through Iran also in Lebanon. And don't forget that what has really emerged is that Iran has now got direct access to the Mediterranean. Mm. And so has through the same route, so has Russia. I was just wondering whether you have really taken that into account.
Yeah, look, thanks, Amin. I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, clearly, in a little talk like this, I can't go into anything like the full details I would in a major paper. And I think that that's right, and I would need to include that aspect. But I would still see what Putin is doing in the Middle East as tactical. The only bit that really relates to strategies, as far as I can see, is actually that it's part of an overall global effort to oppose the US where he can. That's as I see it at the moment. I think he sees the Middle East as an area where the US got itself into the most hideous strife, and he is determined not to repeat that mistake that the US is. The Middle East is an awful place, as you would know, for external powers to get involved. They almost invariably ends in tears.
Okay. So we'll move along, Alexander, and then Graham.
Thanks. I have a question for Matthew. I've heard you mention in your presentation that institutions involving China, Russia, like in Central Asia, for example, evolved predominantly according to China's preferences. I wonder what's your take on India's recent membership in Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which changes basically power and interest balance within this organization. So was it China's preference or Russia's preference?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I think the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has gone from what we might have called China's laboratory about 4 or 5 years ago to now something that China doesn't need very much. I mean, it needed it as an entree into the Central Asian space. And expanded SCO really, I think I made the point very briefly, reinforces Chinese bilateralism, because by bringing in new countries, and particularly India is a key one, that where there's no possibility of what Moscow wants, and that's a strategic triangle between India, Russia, and Beijing, to unite two-thirds of the world's land mass and two-thirds of its GDP and et cetera. There is no possibility of that taking place. So therefore, the SCO transforms into much more of a multilateral talking shop and ultimately a weaker one as well, and a more symbolic one. Whereas previously, it was a very good vehicle, I think, for the articulation and mediation of Sino-Russian disputes, effectively bilateral by proxy. Now you have more serious players in. And so in that respect, I think it does serve Chinese interests, because China is attempting to sell a positive-sum game as part of Belt and Road, but it is not doing so multilaterally, and it's not doing so wedded to any institution or organisation. It's primarily saying, we'll sign up a deal with you, and we will invest this much with you. Now what will the next country give us?
Okay, Ron.
Thanks, Camille. I really enjoyed all of those papers. I've got two comments for Ian and a question for Matt. So the two comments perhaps first. The strategic tactical distinction that you're making, I'm just not sure how that works, actually. I don't know how you distinguish between what's strategy and what's tactics, particularly in a situation like the Middle East where what you can argue is that it might be a subordinate arena within a much broader focus, if you like. And perhaps that's what makes it tactical rather than strategic. But as I say, I'm not sure where the distinction comes, how it works. Second comment is that you've cited Putin's comment about the greatest geopolitical tragedy. You didn't cite what comes immediately after, which is what everybody does. And the paragraph says this is the greatest geopolitical tragedy in the 20th century, and then it goes on to talk about the collapse of the Russian economy and the effect on its people. And, I mean, if you're going to take into account what he says, clearly that's where it's directed. Now, certainly the term geopolitical raises questions about that, but the juxtaposition just seems to be undeniable, and to state it in the way in which is often done, I think Russia and its conditions, or is it a general feature of this notion of rebound? And it's rebound relative to what? Is it rebound relative to that state's own capacity, which is what you seem to be saying? But then later on, you seem to suggest that it might be rebound relative to other states. And they're two very different means of measuring what's happening.
Can I comment?
Yeah, briefly.
Yeah, look, thanks very much, Graham, they're valuable comments. Taking the second one first, just in relation to the geopolitical tragedy aspect, I did make the point that Putin has made clear that he was referring to the stranding of 25 million Russian nationals outside the Soviet Union. He made that point in relation to response to a question from Oliver Stone in the first interview of last Sunday week. My only point was that this has been taken out of context, as you've said, that there's deliberate ambiguity. Well, there's ambiguity, and I put a question mark, was it deliberate? Was he trying to just create an essence of an element of ambiguity there? I don't know. But I do take your point that if it wasn't as simple as many in the West have taken it. I didn't include the rest of the paragraph simply because this was a 20-minute talk. It would have taken up another 30 seconds to do that. As far as the first point is concerned, I certainly have no problem with the idea of distinguishing between what Putin is doing in the Middle East as tactical rather than strategic. I see his strategic approach to the Middle East as related to Europe, to China, to the really big players. I'm quite confident that Putin does not want to have a permanent presence in the Middle East. He wants to influence the Middle East if he can, but I think he's determined that he's not going to get to the stage where if there are casualties for Russia, that starts to impact on his popularity at home. I think he would be very, very careful about that. And he's been quite prepared to use the points that Ming made about the weakness of the US in the region after Iraq, and the fact that a lot of Middle Eastern states were actually coming to him. Saudi Arabia came to him in the aftermath of the intervention in Syria. It had a big impression right across the region, but he's smart enough to know it's not a permanent impression. And it's now, in my view, been not quite nullified, but reduced considerably by the fact that Trump is much more popular among all Middle Eastern states than Obama was.
Yep. Thanks, Graham. Yes. I also don't like Putin taking that out of context. The one that gets me is the one that Putin is saying, everyone who doesn't wish for the return of the USSR has no heart. And then that's always the one that's quoted a bit after it is, anyone who thinks it can return has no brain. On rebound, let me do the second part of your question, or second question first. And with that, I would hide behind John Mearsheimer and internal balancing or alternatively development of latent power. So yes, primarily I'm focused on Russia's capabilities compared to what it was. Right? Now, down the track, that has then relativities with respect to others. But I completely agree it's a different way of measuring it. I'm not trying to do that yet. And in any case, because it's only one case, it would be very silly of me to try and make comments about theory which I've just proposed. So in a way, it's horrendously lazy scholarship, but it is setting the scene for a comparative piece down the track to say, okay, what happens with other rebound cases, so therefore we might get something generalizable out of it.
In terms of Russia's window, 10 to 15 years, this is primarily drawn from, well, what are the things that makes the Russian economy strong, right? Or what are its main drivers? And its drivers are oil and gas, as we know, plus arms sales. And it really does need to ensure that its Asian pivot allows it to establish the same kind of monopolist dependencies in Asia as it has in the West. Because in 10 to 15 years, American fracking will have not just come online, but it'll allow America to export cheaply gas into Europe in a big way. And Europe will see the United States as a much more reliable supplier, one that doesn't use it for strategic purposes, or at least not yet. Same token in Asia, whereas the Russians have signed up, you know, a couple of years ago, the big $400 billion gas deal with China. You know, they're actually losing on that. They're losing on it so that they can sign them up to 25 years and then ratchet the price up like they've done in Europe. So, the United States will come into that area and be a big competitor. Also be a competitor with Australia, which is something that we don't talk about very much, but certainly be a competitor with Russia. So unless you have those access to those fundamental drivers of your economy, but also the drivers of strategic influence, then I think Russia's capacity to shape an order to suit its own preferences, regionally or sub-regionally, is going to decline.
The rebound in principle has a window.
That's a very good question. If the security environment around it is stable, and if the rebound allows you to consolidate that security environment, it's not hostile, I think yes, it doesn't necessarily have a window. But if you're in an area that is hostile, if you have long-term trajectories that are down, if you don't have any natural allies, and if you can't construct a kind of institutional basis, or at least region-wide basis for cooperation, or that buffer zone, then yeah, it is going to, it'd be like a rubber band effect, if you like.
Sorry, Victoria, I'm going to be nasty to you. Just one short question from Roger, and I think we'll close the show.
Just a quick question to Nick regarding your excellent paper. There's been quite a bit of discussion at this conference around is there a new Cold War? And that thesis has been pushed most particularly by Stephen Cohen. And you know, there are reasons to have reservations about the notion of a new Cold War, in the sense that there's no Soviet Union anymore and there's no Marxist-Leninist element and so forth. But Stephen Cohen has also said that domestically, that is in the US, it's actually very difficult for those people who want to say, well, no, the hand of Russia is not everywhere, to actually get a platform. So there's a degree of, anti-Russianism anyway, that if it's not a new Cold War, it at least stifles discussion, creates the image of an enemy that has pervasive influence, and to that extent within the US itself at least, it might be appropriate to call it, for want of a better term at least, some kind of new Cold War. So I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of the domestic scene in the US.
Bearing in mind I'm much more expert about periods leading up to now now, I wouldn't agree that it was a new Cold War because it just doesn't have the scope. I would agree that it serves the same purpose essentially that the Cold War did internally, and that anti-communism did well before the Cold War in that it remains a powerful and useful distraction from domestic problems. When I said before that I thought the US was perhaps at its weakest point in my memory, what I mean is that domestically it's a mess. Yes, it can project power. Yes, it has more weapons. Yes, it has... I'm not discounting all those. But, you know, when it became a superpower, was doing so off a huge manufacturing base. It was making more goods than the rest of the world combined. There was real substance to this, and after the Second World War, it was spreading wealth throughout its own community. It's not doing that anymore. It can't go to war like it used to since Vietnam. People won't stand for it. Couldn't even invade it, couldn't really interfere in Syria. People won't stand for it.
Trump buffoon, you know, he's really out really for self-enrichment, because that's how he's using the office. And he's a wonderful distraction for the GOP, because while everyone's focused on him and his buffoonery, you know, they're trying to push through Congress legislation to destroy Obamacare. So anti-Russian, it's always useful. And America always needs an enemy. And it wasn't me, but I think somebody did the analysis. And when you include the Indian Wars, it's something like for its entire existence, the US has not been at war with somebody for only 2 years.
Sorry, it was a highly stimulating discussion which can be continued at lunchtime. Not now, because we have back-to-back sessions, so you have really, really 1 minute to regroup. But in the meantime, let us thank the panelists. So is your session now?
Yeah.